If you were with us last week, you might recall that we heard the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000. And even if you weren't here, it is probably known to you as one of the most important and well-known stories about Jesus. A dramatic and beautiful, wonderful story of healings and feedings and how it ended with 12 baskets of leftovers and crumbs. How it started with certainly not enough to go around and ended with more than enough leftovers. Today's story, which is only one chapter later in the gospel according to Matthew, could not be a more different tone, could it? How one who was so quickly, almost automatically moved to compassion for the crowds that showed up seems here to struggle to have compassion for one unnamed woman. It's ironic. It's also true that in both cases, however, the story is more than just about the crumbs. Today's story from the Gospel according to Matthew is the story of Jesus and the Canaanite woman. It's a story that's found also in the Gospel according to Mark, where this woman is identified as a Syrophoenician woman. Jesus has departed from his usual stomping grounds of his ministry in and around the Sea of Galilee with the Jewish communities that were not far from his hometown. And he and his disciples are journeying now to the mostly non-Jewish areas near that region of the Mediterranean, the Gentile or pagan territories. But from his later comments, it seems clear that he did not intend to travel there for the sake of recruiting followers or for evangelism. While there, this local woman recognizes Jesus and calls out to him, runs after him, for the healing of her tormented daughter. Jesus apparently ignores her. The disciples ask him to send her away. And he responds to his disciples with a rather clear statement that his ministry is to the lost of Israel. Jews only. People like them. Yet this woman will not relent. She keeps asking him for help, and he rebuffs her with this astonishingly cold response. It is not fair to take the children's food and give it to the dogs. Still undeterred, this woman will not retreat, and she does not remain silent, neither does she take the bait. She verbally turns the tables and says, "Yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the table." It's then that Jesus apparently sees her, hears her, gets it. Great is your faith. Let it be done as you wish. And her daughter, she discovers, is healed instantly. To me, this scene has perhaps the hardest saying found on the lips of Jesus, the hardest one for me to hear. Now, we might be accustomed to hearing or even appreciating the anger and outbursts that Jesus may have had against the unjust leaders and systems of his day. We might even understand how he reprimands his own followers for their lack of understanding or slowness. Yet this exchange, to first ignore a woman in need and then to respond with a comment that in any age is demeaning, it is painful. It's shocking to hear from our Jesus. Because we identify Jesus as a champion of the oppressed and excluded, as he is so often rightly portrayed in the Gospels. But the just, the kind, even the passionate Jesus is here portrayed using language that is at best derogatory, if not an actual ethnic or racial slur. It is astonishing that this picture of Jesus is even preserved in the Gospels, which celebrate him as our teacher, healer, and savior. You know, it's the uncomfortableness of that picture that actually makes it more likely that it's based in a real occurrence that happened. Because you don't usually like to tell an uncomfortable story about the hero of the story. The fact that this uncomfortable story is there is pretty good evidence that something like this must have happened. Now, it wasn't uncommon for Jews to call non-Jews dogs. But even if it was common, there is no getting around it, going over it or under it or avoiding it. Jesus here is at best, portrayed as ethnocentric, and at worst, could be heard as insensitive or even racist. Yet the healing of the daughter is accomplished. It's not Jesus who, only verses before this, served thousands and walked on water. Jesus doesn't come out of this story as the hero. The unnamed pagan woman is the hero of this story. Her tenacity and her words are the climax. Her persistence, her strength not to take the bait of an insult, her quick rhetorical skill in this verbal exchange trumps even Jesus himself. And he allows her response to stand unopposed. Not only does he grant her request, she turns out to be the hero of this gospel story. Because it's not Jesus, but it is she who advances the good news of the gospel. I love this story because it's one of the most unique that we have in our gospels. Now, there is scholarly consensus that the story stands as a witness to how the barriers between Jews and Gentiles were broken down. That was a long-standing barrier in the biblical tradition, and it was a tense and really lively issue in the early Christian movement as it grew beyond its Jewish roots. This story reflects that those cultural and religious tensions were resolved, and it roots the resolution in the ministry that Jesus practiced. But surprisingly, we have to notice again, the resolution isn't based on Jesus' initiative. It's based in this confrontation that he has with a Gentile woman who transformed Jesus, opened Jesus up to even larger possibilities. It would seem that God's plan was bigger than even Jesus first imagined. Now, many of us in this room might easily identify with the Canaanite woman. Because many in this room, whether it's because of a personal history, age, race, gender identity, ability, sexual orientation, endless list, many in this room, have we ever sometimes felt like we were begging others, maybe even begging God, not even to sit at the table, but just for a crumb of grace? Do you ever feel like you have begged for a crumb of grace? Argued for a blessing for ourselves or someone like us? So if you have ever found yourself there, if I have ever found myself there, this nameless woman is our patron saint. She got more than crumbs. She broke the good news wide open for all of us. And there remains an unsettling picture of Jesus. You know, we may wish to identify only with the woman in the story, but that actually skirts the greater discomfort because the Gospels are told so that we will identify and follow Jesus in the stories. So I think our discomfort or avoidance of this Jesus story and Jesus saying is based upon how much we like to perceive Jesus is so different from us, or are afraid to welcome him as the same as us. Now, centuries of Christian theology proclaim Jesus fully divine and fully human, but don't we secretly prefer that he was really way more divine than human? We want to follow a worship an always wonderful, divinely powerful, walking on water, feeding the hungry, including the excluded Jesus. But this story presents us with a fully human Jesus who struggled with the same unpleasant limitations that we all have. Someone who may have been taught to believe it was okay to ignore certain people, who may have been raised with certain cultural prejudices, maybe even raised that it was acceptable to call certain people names. That makes Jesus a little too uncomfortably human, a little too uncomfortably like you and me. The image we see in the mirror of Jesus is a little too clear, a little too sharp for our taste. I think it's kind of like we prefer Jesus had something like a get out of human free card. An escape from your social, cultural, familial, historical context card. An exception that wasn't touched by prejudices around him. So do we see Jesus as the great exception or the great example? There are two miracles in this story. First, the miracle of the physical healing of this woman's daughter, and the second was the miracle of the healing of overcoming prejudice and the boundaries that separate people. The teaching, healing, saving work of Jesus is set by the example of the transformation of Jesus himself, not by the exception that he entered every circumstance perfectly. The example of healing from the wounding prejudices and boundaries that separate people, modeled by Jesus himself. So, we can easily identify with the Canaanite woman if we dare to gaze in the mirror held up by the example of Jesus in this story. Who are the, quote, dogs in our communities? Do we sometimes believe or begin with the same assumption that Jesus apparently held, at least for a time? We may believe we know what we are called to do, to whom we are called. This is our community. This is the scope of our lives. This is the scope of our ministry, the boundaries, and here. We're very well bounded sometimes. The love and the grace and the touch and the transformation of God reaches this far only. The world and the people beyond that reach, well, we may not call them dogs, certainly not to their face. But homeless, mentally ill, fundamentalists, immigrants, Muslims, polyamorous. Well, you people are on your own. If you insist, here are some crumbs. What did Jesus do? When he was confronted with the smallness of his vision and ministry, rather than defending his limitations, he opened up, he shifted, he changed, he healed, he was transformed. Isn't that what will happen if we dare to open up to someone we view as, quote, the other? In June of 1991, Michael and Julie Weiser had moved to their new home in Lincoln, Nebraska. Michael was about to serve in a position as cantor of a local Jewish congregation in Lincoln. Only a few days after they arrived in town, they received a package. And the package was full of hate material that included a card that said, "The KKK is watching you." And they received hateful phone calls, one of which said, "You're going to be sorry you moved in, Jew boy." That threatening message was from Larry Trapp, who was the grand dragon of the Lincoln Ku Klux Klan. And having heard him interviewed on TV and radio, Weiser recognized his voice. So, rather than leave town, Weiser decided to get Trapp's phone number and to call him back. Now, at 42, Trapp was nearly blind and had lost both of his legs to diabetes. So when Weiser called and left a message on Trapp's answering machine, he said, "With your physical disabilities, the Nazis would have made you the first to go." Then he left another message later, "You're going to have to answer to God for all of this one day, Larry." And then a message, "There is a lot of love out there, Larry, and you're not getting any. Don't you want some?" So over the course of weeks, over several weeks, Weiser left about 10 such messages. And his wife, Julie, had told him, "If he ever picks up and answers the phone, you have to be prepared to say something nice to him." And eventually, Trapp did pick up the phone, and Michael said that he knew that Larry had a hard time getting around, and he offered him a ride to go and buy groceries. The line went quiet, and Larry replied, "Well, I've got that taken care of, but thanks for asking." So a month went by, and Trapp once again called the Weisers. And this time he said, "I'm not feeling right about the KKK anymore. I've got to talk to you. I want out." So the Weisers jumped on the opportunity to go and visit him at his apartment and brought dinner. Before she left, Julie went to the jewelry box and found a silver ring that she had earlier given Michael years before that he was no longer wearing, because she decided she would give it to Trapp as a gesture of goodwill. Before leaving, Michael called a friend and said, "If we're not back in a while, call the police." Which was a wise precaution, because even though they were not aware, Trapp kept an arsenal of weapons loaded in his small apartment. When they arrived, Trapp took Michael's hands and burst into tears. He took off his two swastika rings and gave them to the Weisers and said, "I don't want these anymore in my life." And the Weisers were crying, and they gave Larry the ring that Julie had brought. 4 hours later, after sharing dinner, the Weisers left with all of Larry's KKK, Nazi, and white supremacist propaganda, including the hood, the beret, and a Nazi flag. Over the months that followed, Larry went through such a transformation that the Ku Klux Klan started threatening him. He made apologies, he joined the NAACP, he spoke in public schools, was interviewed by Time magazine, and as Trapp's illness progressed, he moved into the Weiser home, where Julie took care of him, and he became known to the Weisers' three teenage children as Uncle Larry. And maybe most remarkably, this former grand dragon of the KKK converted to Judaism in the synagogue he had threatened to bomb. 3 months after that, he passed away in the Weisers' home, surrounded by this new family. That story inspired a book by Catherine Watterson called Not by Sword, and a song by David Roth called Dragon to Butterfly. And the last few lines of that song are this: Larry's last breath in his bedroom at Michael's came later that night with his friends at his side. Thank you was all he could whisper for changing a dragon into a butterfly. How different can our world be? How different can our lives be if we stop defending our limitations and our prejudices and open up and allow God's transformation to happen? For us as followers of another rabbi, Jesus, is it the example before or the example after the encounter with the Canaanite mother that we will follow? The depth of God's love, the reach of God's healing is larger than our perceived limits, larger than the crumbs of our cultural expectations, more than the leftovers of our personal histories. Are we ready for more good news to open up and move through us? Whether it starts as our idea or not, it appears to be God's idea.